Moncrief on News Talk.
Anyone serving time in prison has a story about how they ended up there. And that story may throw considerable light on how to help prevent others from ending up in the same situation. So Senator Lynn Ruan and the filmmaker Grace Diaz set up a project where men in Mountjoy Prison could tell those stories. It's now in the form of a book called What We're Made Of. Lynn, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Sean.
What's really interesting about this is the process, because originally these were plays. Tell us about that process and how that worked.
Yeah, so I've been doing work in the prison, Sean, for a long time now, and I'm constantly trying to come up with ways, I suppose, that people in prison can contribute to not only their own rehabilitation and integration, but actually help solve, I suppose, the issues for other people who end up in similar situations. And we came up with an idea that they wanted to explore power, and that came from the men. And that was initially whether that was the power imbalance between each other or them and the system, or them as children and what the education system meant to them and stuff. So I had been aware for a while of the process of the Theatre of the Oppressed, which was developed by Augusta Boal, who was a dramatist, went on to become a senator actually, and would use this kind of forum theatre to tease out and role play different scenarios of power and oppression. So myself and Grace, because I was aware that obviously I would need a dramatist because that wouldn't be my skill set, and Grace had told me years before about the Theatre of the Oppressed. So myself and Grace sat down and we applied to the Arts Council and were successful and were able to go in and work with the men with the go-ahead from the IPS, obviously, which was great, to spend 6 months using Theatre of the Oppressed skills and tools and games and everything that's involved in being able to actually explore the topic of power and oppression. And funnily enough, like, some of the men were like, I didn't even realise I was oppressed. You know, some of them weren't too happy to realise, like, oh shit, you know, I'm depressed, oppressed. I didn't realise just how much power is at play in one's life. And it was really powerful because the men would come into the room and they would have different scenes written out. And then when they really understood, I suppose, the intergenerational impact maybe of their own lives, some of them had fathers or parents who were institutionalized themselves, whether that be in, you know, industrial schools, the Christian Brothers, and they started to piece together their life, I suppose, or their relationship to violence or their relationship to the state. And they began to make sense of that for themselves then. So they basically wrote the plays, directed the plays. They were two big, huge shows that we put on, and we invited 150 state actors in.
Yeah.
So anybody basically that came up in the scenarios or the scenes, we found representatives to invite in to the prison to be able to be part of the process so that we could find solutions together.
Now, and that's where it becomes very interesting, perhaps uncomfortable for some of the members of that invited audience. Is this correct that then there was one performance put on by the prisoners, but then they invited some of the members of the audience to take part in a second performance of it?
So we had two separate shows, and what happens is, because we had two big productions, one on the progression unit and one in the main jail, so two totally different shows, so it was quite heavy and full on. And the play would run through. It could last for an hour and a half. You could put it on any stage in the world, and I think it would sell out nightly. Like, I mean, really powerful, really artistic and really talented, but also really important and very uncomfortable at times. It's very uncomfortable to talk about violence. And I think the men were able to make violence and the conversation around that a little bit more palpable by putting it into this artistic expression. So, you know, the room was quite blown away. I think we had ministers, heads of TUSLA, heads of the HSE, heads of Garda Representative Association, CAP, anyone that featured, I suppose, in the lifetime, you know, judges, everyone that featured in the lifetime. So the play would roll out and then the men would begin the play again. And it's in the second time of the men doing the whole theatre piece, the audience could then tag in, basically. And they could tag in as themselves in the current role that they have, or they may see another solution where a different type of maybe answer was needed. So they could tag in as, say, a social worker, or they could tag in as a minister or as a parent, or, you know, so they begin to then find solutions together to how could we have actually changed the course or the direction of this situation or of the men's lives or working class people in general, maybe, that may come up against similar circumstances.
Yeah. And the scenario for this performance, you know, roughly speaking, what was it?
Yes.
And I assume it was the various men got together and found points of commonality in telling that story.
Oh, yeah. Like we call the men, they're all called Pedro because it's kind of an everyman story. The men felt that even though they were the ones telling the story, that the story could be told by, you know, thousands of men across different urban communities, especially across Ireland and other countries. So it's kind of, we have one umbrella character, I suppose, that captures everyone. So one of the scenarios happened in a cell, actually. It was the old St. Pat's that used to house boys in an adult's prison, which was obviously very wrong. So some of these men had come through Pat's themselves, and then we brought them back into that space, into the basement. So we had like the DG of the Justice Department, we'd Paul Reid, we'd different people in the cell with the men. And one of the scenarios that we played out was the cycle of violence. So it was the violence that the young boy experienced within the home, then within the community, then with the guards, and then with the prison officers. And it rolls through the cycles really quickly. And it's actually people had to leave because people got quite upset. You know, we had to create a safe space because, you know, people left crying. It was very intense. But people got involved and people wanted to find ways to be able to support that family, support that young man. Because when he was a little boy, Sean, people will feel sorry for him because he's like, well, he's just a little boy and he's experiencing all this violence. But when that little boy becomes a man, we kind of don't allow him no longer the victimhood of all the trauma he's experienced because now he's a perpetrator. And people's empathy wanes off, and then we stop looking at the core drivers, which doesn't help that individual reduce violence in their lives because we never actually get to the point where we help them heal from the core drivers of everything that's happened to them previous. You know, most of the men would say that their first experience of violence was not as a perpetrator. It was as a victim. Mm-hmm. So what we wanted to explore is how can we reduce victimization and how can we reduce the cycle of violence by working with the small percentage of men, especially who cause the most violence. And often they're closest to the solutions. We don't often work with that group. And really, they're the ones with the lived and living experience of what could and couldn't have worked maybe in their particular life or experience. And I think we're trying to include them men, not only artistically, but also politically to be able to change society. Because what all those men agreed on was that they didn't want younger men experiencing what they did. Like younger men look up to them or think that they're cool or think that they're hard. When actually in the room, them men are going, I was scared, like I was frightened coming in here for the first time, but people wouldn't have realised that. And the men, that's why the book came about, Sean, because the men wanted to leave a legacy of the players because nobody else got to see the players because they're obviously in a prison. So the book was to try and capture a legacy piece that could be used as an educational tool. And then the men decided, and some of these men don't have money or family, some of them grew up in care, so they don't have people coming in and, you know, leaving them in new clothes or whatever at Christmas. And all of them agreed unanimously, even though not all of them have a lot of support, that they didn't want any of the proceeds of the book. They wanted the proceeds of the book to go towards a similar program for the versions of them at 14, 15, 16 years old. So they wanted to give back and pass that on.
It sounds from what you said that a lot of them grew up in a kind of a situation where language was a sort of violence and maybe the main language that they were given.
Yeah. But also capital, you know, they kind of identified that not a lot of them had much capital in their lives, whether it be financial, educational, social, cultural. And sometimes growing up in a harsh environment, sometimes you create violence as a form of capital so that you're not preyed upon or that you're picked on or that you're seen as someone like, stay away from me, you know. And one young man, he's in his late 30s now, but he wrote about the experience of his father basically teaching him violence, not as a form to necessarily go out and hurt other people, but to protect himself because he had been so badly abused by the Christian Brothers. And he felt that if been able to fight them back. He wouldn't have been abused in that way. So people's kind of relationship of violence becomes quite warped in a sense, you know, and you have to kind of tease all that back out and be able to forms of capital to be able to live their lives and negotiate their way out of situations without hurting other people.
Mm. Now, all the stakeholders who are in the room, and you could see how many of them might have an input into the criminal justice system or TUSLA or the education system, but I suppose there was no one in that room, or there couldn't be anyone in that room, who could affect the fundamental reason why we have crime of this sort, because a lot of that's to do with inequality and poverty.
Exactly. It's the structural and systematic stuff. But the thing is, the people in the room who do have power in some ways, the men was kind of putting a question to them in a sense is, what are you going to do differently now that you understand oppression in a different kind of way? You know, and are you more willing to work with people like us who are being rightly held accountable for the crimes we committed or the violence that we inflicted on people? But we're also now willing to work with you. So we're offering you a new way to do your work where you help rehumanize people and not dehumanize people, because societies aren't safe if we create monsters, and you don't create safe societies by further ostracizing people. You have to find a way to help people heal so that they don't inflict any sort of hurt and pain on anybody else. And I think that that was one of the biggest messages with the people in the room. But there's also a lot of people in the room that have a lot of power, have a lot of resources, and they do have the means and the way to be able to actually at least contribute to that systematic change. Yeah. And some of that starts with just even reframing our own thoughts and thinking. We have to be able to create a new narrative in our heads, because ultimately there's an emotional response really when people commit crimes that are obviously, you know, completely abhorrent, or lives have been lost. So people have emotional reactions, and that's understandable. But we can't just have a warehouse where we create this factory that doesn't know what it's making. And we put all these men in this factory, in this warehouse, and then we expect them to come out the other side and have some sort of changed society without actually ever really getting in there under the bonnet and doing the work with people, and also addressing the core drivers. Yeah. There's lots of work done in America. There's this amazing guy called James Gilligan who works in the States, in the prisons over there. And all the evidence that him and others produce is that some of the core drivers of violence are shame, humiliation, and not being able to meet one's economic needs. And we explored all of those topics, myself and Grace, with the men and then with the audiences. So if we can reduce it even down to those three things, how do we improve people's economic stability? How do we reduce their exposure, I suppose, to situations where shame accumulates over time because they're living in certain conditions, or their housing quality is not great, or their parents have experienced extreme circumstances in the education system and whatnot. So if you look at shame, humiliation and economic needs, I think if we it feels more like we can grasp that, how do we reduce those things and how do we improve those things? And then I think it becomes a little bit more manageable in terms of what steps we may need to take.
Mm. And it should be said that, because you did mention kind of shaping a narrative around prisoners, that one of the stakeholders who was there was representing the media. And
yes,
many of those prisoners feel that you know, they're always going to be represented in the same way, no matter how far it's been since they committed their crime or done their service.
Exactly. And that doesn't create safer society for other people. So I think most of society can agree on one core thing, and that is we don't want victims of crime and we don't want victims of violence. So if we can all agree that that's the center point, well, then we go, well, how do we make sure that we get to that? How can we get closer to that? So somebody spends 10, 20, 30 years in prison, and while they're in prison, they engage fully in psychology, fully in the addiction services. Maybe they're after going to open university and getting their degree, and then they want to come out, and their goal, their main goal, is to do no more harm. But the second they leave the prison, the papers print, you know, psycho this, or this man unremorseful, you know, but has never met them, has never actually looked at all the work that they've done while they're in prison. It doesn't really add to a sense of safety. if we're not going to allow people to change. And I think I and Grace, and I hopefully lots of like the listeners and other people in Ireland, believe that people have the capacity to change, while also the rest of society has the capacity to change the systematic failures. Because I think if we don't believe in those things, we're kind of saying that everything is just, it's just all fate. Then we just accept things as they are, and we just accept that there's good and bad and poor and rich, and none of us really try and improve anything.
Lynn, thanks a million for speaking with us today. That was Senator Lynn Rowan there, the independent senator for Trinity College. A few comments about this. In my opinion, says one person, most inmates in prison have a certain amount of trauma. We need a complete overhaul of our legal and justice systems. A lot more compassion and empathy is needed in today's society. Yes, but then again, you know, you will hear, and I'm sure there are people out there right now saying, what about the victims of crime? And they would have far less sympathy from that point of view, or indeed from the work that Lynn has been doing. This sort of subject is so misunderstood by most people, says somebody else. Sociology is empathy and should be taught in secondary schools. I think if we all understand each other's circumstances better, we will have a better society with more compassion. Growing up, we had very few options, says this texter. Ended up in prison, dead, or emigrate. My dad was lucky that he got away, but a lot of the boys he grew up with were not so lucky. And I'm sure a lot of people have that experience. I love documentaries that go behind the doors of a prison and expose the reality of the day-to-day life of prisoners. You have to have sympathy on a human level, says another texter. And finally, someone says, I often think that only a very small cohort of the population know what the experience of prison is like. Well, obviously, unless most of us are going to prison. Most of us lead happy and comfortable lives. We are cushioned away from the brutality and loneliness of a prison sentence. I always felt it was a good idea for schools to do tours of prison to show children how different your life may turn out.
Moncrief, weekdays at 2 p.m. on News Talk.